Usha, Sufis, the People of the Path, Volume 1, Talks on Sufism, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 15.
Bhagwan, a certain man who was fond of studying all kinds of systems of thought wrote to a dervish master, Abdul Aziz of Mecca, asking whether he could talk to him in order to make comparisons. The dervish sent him a bottle with oil and water in it, and a piece of cotton wick. Enclosed in the package was this letter. Dear friend, if you place the wick in the oil, you will get light when fire is applied to it. If you pour out the oil and put wick in the water, you will get no light. If you shake up the oil and water and then place the wick in them, you will get a spluttering and a going out. There is no need to carry out this experiment through words and visits when it can be done with such simple materials as these.
Sufism is existential, though not existentialist. Existentialism is a contradiction in terms. The whole approach of existentialism is that existence is not a system and cannot be converted into a system. That existence remains an experience. There is no way to make a philosophy out of it, and yet existentialism itself has become a philosophy. The Western mind is so addicted with speculation and philosophizing that even something which is basically anti-philosophic eventually turns into a philosophy. Something which is fundamentally a non-system by and by becomes a perfect system. And German mind is more systematic in that way. In Germany, Karl Jaspers had made, out of existentialist approach towards reality, a great system. It is amazing. The whole standpoint is that the systematization is not possible. But you can systematize even this approach, this attitude. You can philosophize against philosophy. You can create a philosophy of no philosophy. But then you are again lost into the mire of words, theories, hypotheses, propositions, logic, and it is non-ending. That's why I say Sufism is existential, not existentialist. It has no ism. It has no philosophy to teach. It has no proposition to propose. It has no doctrine to indoctrinate people. It is just a finger pointing to the moon. It is an indication. Indication towards reality, not towards words. It is experience and experiment. It abhors all kinds of philosophies. Because philosophy is the deepest cause of man getting lost into language and linguistic patterns. And life has no language. Life is silent. Or silence is its only language. It speaks only through silence. So when you are silent, you are in communion with it. Life is meditative. It is not a kind of thinking. It is a state of no thinking. When you are in that state of no thinking, suddenly there is communion. All barriers between you and life disappear. You are no more separate from it, not standing against it and thinking about it. You are it. And you know only when you are it. You know only when the knower is no more there. You know only when all knowledge has disappeared. You know through being, not through knowing. So Sufism, down the ages, has been very condemnatory about philosophizing. It is not scriptural. It is not logical. It is very realistic. It is very pragmatic. Hence its appeal for the modern mind, for the mind which is trained more in the ways of science than in the ways of philosophy. Science is experiment. You can't trust speculation. You have to experiment with reality. You have to see reality as it is, not through a certain prejudice of your mind. You need not have any belief. You can simply go into reality without any belief, and the reality will conclude. Reality is conclusive. The conclusion comes not by thinking, but by looking into reality. And if you have a certain idea, a priori, that very idea becomes a distraction. It won't allow you to see that which is. So Sufis say, don't have any ideas, don't have any beliefs. There is nothing to believe. Yes, there is much to know, but there is nothing to believe. There is no need to believe. And all kinds of belief are fear-oriented. I have heard a man an old gentleman suddenly felt the time had come to be taken into the bosom of the church. Abraham warned his parson, "You must have faith. Do you believe everything in the Bible?" "Yes, sir," insisted Abraham. "Do you believe the story of Jonah and the whale and Daniel and the lions, those hungry African lions that had not a single thing to eat? Daniel, you know, walks right into their den and slaps them in the face, and they don't do nothing to him. If that is what the Bible says, I believe it. And do you believe the story of the Hebrew children in the fiery furnace? They walks right into that furnace, steps on the hot coals, and they aren't even singed. Not even singed. A regular fire. Right, not even singed." "Deacon," said Abraham, "I don't believe in that." "Then you can't be taken into the bosom of the church." Abraham sadly picked up his hat and shuffled toward the door. "And parson," he added, "I don't believe that story about Daniel and the lions neither." Nobody really believes these stories. Not even those who pretend to believe. Not even those who say they have great faith. No, it is impossible. By the very nature of consciousness, it is impossible to believe unless you know. All belief is against nature. All belief is just a repression of your doubts. Yes, you can repress your doubts if there is great fear. You can repress your doubts if there is great greed. If you are offered heavenly pleasures and paradise, and you are threatened by the hell fire and the devils who are going to torture you. If these things are put in your mind, you start believing. But you know all the time. All the time underneath, you know, you doubt. How can you believe? How can anyone believe unless one has known himself? Unless you have faced reality as it is, there is no possibility to have faith. Faith does not come by fear, does not come by greed. Faith comes only through experience. Sufis teach a different kind of world view. Not based on beliefs, but based on experiments, experience, and the conclusions that come through those experiments and experiences naturally. Then there is a totally different kind of faith. No, but doubt is repressed there in it. It is total. It does not divide you. It does not split you. Otherwise, Christians, Hindus and Mohammedans and all kinds of believers are split personalities, schizophrenic. Schizophrenia is one of the commonest traits of man. And why man is schizophrenic? The reason has to be found in the so-called religious teachings, indoctrinations. When you tell somebody to believe in something, you are creating a neurosis in him. You are creating a division. Now he will never be one. He will be two. One part, the real part, will go on doubting, and the unreal part, the superficial part, will go on believing. And this will go on becoming bigger and bigger, this rift. And this rift will always create great anxiety. You look into any of your beliefs. You believe in God, and you look, you know that you doubt. I have heard a little boy came home from Sunday school, and his father asked, "What did you learn today?" "Well," said the youngster, 2,000 years ago, the Jews wanted to escape from the bad Egyptians. So Moses had the Jews build this suspension bridge across the Red Sea. Then they loaded it down with dynamite. The Jews escaped across the bridge, and when all the Egyptians chased them, they blew up the bridge and all the Egyptians were drowned.
"Is that what the teacher told you?" asked the surprised father. "No," said the boy, "but you would never believe the crazy story he did tell us."
He has improved upon the story. All your so-called scriptures are full of nonsense. But you go on believing just because you are afraid, because you are not grounded in your being, because you are not rooted in reality. The father was a Christian Scientist and always carried a copy of Mistress Eddy's works in his pocket, accompanied by his little son, he had an occasion to cross a lot where a good-sized goat was feeding. As they approached the goat, the boy showed fear, whereat his father told him to think it not possible for the animal to harm them. But the boy, remembering previous encounters with the goat, in which he came out second best, did not grow any braver. "Papa, you are a Christian scientist, all right," he said, "and so am I, but the goat does not know about it. The reality has never heard about your beliefs, your philosophies, your religions. It is completely unaware of all that nonsense that you go on carrying in your head. It has no concern with your head trips. It is simply innocent. It is neither Hindu nor Mohammedan nor Christian. It has no adjective. It has no scriptures. No likes, no dislikes. It is simply there, naked. To know this reality, you will have to be naked of all your beliefs. Those beliefs function as your clothes. Spiritual clothes, yes, that's what they are. And because of those clothes, you never come into contact with reality. One has to be naked to come in contact with the sun rays. One has to be naked to be in contact with the wind. One has to be naked if one wants to dance in the rain, and one wants to feel the rain showering on one's being and body. Exactly so, one has to be spiritually naked and mute if one wants to have any participation with reality as it is. Sufism is an effort to denude you of all your belief systems, of all words. That's why in Sufism the master is not a teacher. The master is more like an artisan, an artist, a painter, a carpenter maybe, a weaver. The master is more like one who knows a certain skill, which cannot be taught through words, which can only be taught through experience. So in Sufism there is no teacher. Masters are there, but no teacher. And in Sufism, the disciple is not a student. The disciple is an apprentice. Take note of that great distinction. The master is not a teacher and the disciple is not a student. The master is an artisan who knows a certain art, who has the knack of doing a certain thing. The disciple is an apprentice who lives in the presence of the master, so that by and by, slowly, slowly, he can drink more of the presence of the master and can become aware of the knack that he has. It is not an ordinary thing to be transferred, because it cannot be put into words. If you ask somebody, he may be a great swimmer, "How do you do it? Can you teach me? Can you give me a few lessons sitting in your room?" It will be difficult for him to teach you swimming. He would ask you to come with him to the river or to the swimming pool. Swimming is an art. There is no way to teach it. Or bicycling. You know bicycling. But if somebody asks you, explain it philosophically, how do you manage to do it? And no bicyclist has yet been able to explain it. How do you manage to do it? It is a kind of knack. You do it. You manage to do it. But you cannot explain how. The only way is you can tell the person who is inquiring to come with you, and you can help him to manage himself. Then he will know. But when he comes to know, he will also not be able to convey his knowledge through words. It is only conveyed through actions. A Sufi master has no teaching. He is his teaching. A Sufi master does not philosophize about reality, but exposes his heart to the disciples. Even if sometimes he uses words, those words are only indicators. Just like arrows being used on milestones. Just indicators that you have to go on and on. As the disciple becomes more and more attuned with the master, then less and less words are needed. Then the presence of the master is enough. The master teaches by two things. One is his presence, and very paradoxically the other is his absence. The master teaches by his presence and by his absence. In one sense, he is utterly present. In each moment, he is totally there. Each moment is luminous with his presence. His each gesture, act, is full of his presence. It is never absent-minded. He is utterly there and then. The disciple learns much by his radiant presence. He starts learning to be more present, to be more alert, to be more total. And on the other hand, the master is absolutely absent because he has no ego. Nothing like the idea of I anymore exists in him. There is absolute silence. No selfness. What Sufis call fana. The master has disappears. First the disciple learns his presence, and by and by he becomes capable of entering into his absence. This is a kind of art of being present and absent simultaneously. The greatest art, because this is the greatest paradox. To be present and yet to be not present. Present in the sense of presence, of awareness, consciousness, and absent in the sense that there is no self, no ego. This emptiness and this light which fills the emptiness cannot be conveyed, communicated through words. The disciple has to be with the master as an apprentice. He has to taste the being of the master. This small parable will throw much light. A certain man who was fond of studying all kinds of systems of thought, wrote to a dervish master, Abdul Aziz of Mecca, asking whether he could talk to him in order to make comparisons. Pay attention to each word. Sufis are very, very particular about words. First, they don't use many words. If they use, they use them very telegraphically. A certain man who was fond of studying all kinds of systems of thoughts wrote to a dervish master, Abdul Aziz of Mecca, asking whether he could talk to him in order to make comparisons. Now this is what millions of people go on doing in the name of seeking and searching for truth. First, there are the worldly people who don't bother about truth, who never seek and never search. Out of millions of these worldly people who go on and on doing the non-essential, sometimes somebody becomes a little fed up, seeing the futility of all these things that he has been doing. He starts seeking for truth. He wants to know the meaning of life or who he is. But again, there is a great trap. The trap is he may start looking into scriptures, into philosophical systems. First he was lost into the world of things, now he will be lost into the world of thoughts. And the second is far more dangerous than the first. Let me repeat it. Because ordinarily you think that the second is better than the first. It is not so. From the first, it is very easy to awake. Because the first is so stupid. If somebody is really stupid and thick, only then he will go on and on seeking money and power and prestige and respectability and never becoming aware that he is seeking rubbish. For it you need really a dense head. If you are a little intelligent, just a little intelligence is there, that's enough to become alert of the phenomenon that you can accumulate as much money as you want, but you will be dying. And this money is not going to help. This money is not going to be with you. You cannot carry it to the other source. It is such a simple fact. That you may become very respectable, what is the point? Unless you become joyful, what is the point? You can see very respectable people and absolutely joyless. You can see very rich people and they have not known a single moment of celebration. You can see famous people, celebrities, but they know nothing of celebration. In fact, they are looking in a direction which is simply futile, irrelevant. What a person looks when he starts looking for fame, wants to become a celebrity, what he is looking for? This man has missed love. He could not get love from a single human being because he could not love a single human being. He could not give love. So love has not flown towards him. He has missed love. That joy never happened to him. Now he lives through a substitute. He lives through people's respect and fame. So many people know about me. Now this is a vicarious way of fulfilling one's desire that people love you. But those people who know you don't love you. They may even hate you. And even if their sympathy is for you or they respect you, it can't fulfill that unfulfilled gap in your being, that hole in your being that only can be fulfilled by love. It is not a substitute. No substitutes help. All substitutes are plastic. So one can go on and on, earning fame, money, power, and deep down one remains very, very poor, a child. One knows that one has not bloomed, because there is no blooming except love. Money becomes the substitute, our power, our prestige. But it is as if you have misunderstood the menu for the food. You can have beautiful menus, but they are not going to satisfy. Real food is needed. Real food means love. And a single human being's love is enough to fulfill. There is no need to have the whole world love you. If a single human being has loved you, there is fulfillment. And I would like you to tell you that even if you have loved yourself, that is enough. But you don't love yourself, and nobody has loved you, and you have never allowed anybody to love you. Because you cannot give. Because you don't know how to share. Because you are a miser and a hoarder. So you go on hoarding money, and money becomes your beloved, and power becomes your god. Or, if you are a little intelligent, these things will be finished. Then knowledge, philosophy, thought, a far bigger realm of illusion than the things. When you are chasing a woman, at least you are very close to reality. When you are hankering for a beautiful house, at least that house is a real house. At least it has a material, concrete existence. But when you start roaming in the world of thoughts, dreams, projections, God, paradise, just palaces made because you can dream and imagine, then you are completely lost. So sometimes intelligent people become aware of the futility of the world of things, but that they are trapped into the world of thoughts. Thoughts are your inventions. You can have beautiful thoughts, but they are not going to fulfill. Even things cannot fulfill, so how thoughts can fulfill? Even things prove futile, so thoughts are going to prove futile. But with the thought there is one possibility. There are millions of systems. You can move from one system to another. And there is great possibility to create your own system. Just choosing, borrowing few thoughts from here and there, you can put your own system. And the reality will never give you any resistance. Because the reality does not bother what you think. Nobody takes any note of your thinking. It is private. It is your business. It is nobody else's concern. So you can go on and on in thinking. It is not accidental that great philosophers tend to be insane. It is not a coincidence that all the great philosophers in the West, one day or other, have to be hospitalized for insanity. When you go to the very extreme of thought, you lose all contact with reality. You become insane. What is insanity? Losing contact with reality. Becoming so much absorbed in your thoughts that you think that this is the only reality there is. A certain man who was fond of studying all kinds of systems of thought wrote a letter to Abdul Aziz asking whether he could talk to him in order to make comparisons. Now, coming to a master like Abdul Aziz and asking him that he wants to have a little talk, a conversation, a discussion with him, so that he can compare with other systems. This is absolutely foolish. It is as if you are thirsty and you have been reading about water, great poetry about water, great paintings about water you have been seeing, and then you ask a river, can I come to have a little talk with you, so that I can compare my thoughts about water with your idea of water. The river will simply laugh at your ridiculousness, at your stupidity. The river is there, you can drink, and you can quench your thirst. To ask a master like Abdul Aziz that I want to come to talk to you so that I can make comparisons is just the very extreme of foolishness. One comes to a master not to talk, but to see. One comes to a master not to discuss, because discussion will create a barrier. It will create a smoke and vision will become impossible. One comes to a master to have a taste, how it tastes to be realized. One comes to a master to have a sip out of his cup. One comes to a master so that one can see through the master, because he has become open. He is a window. He is no more a wall. If you come close enough, you can see through his eyes, and you can hear through his ears, and you can smell through his nose, and you can have a little glimpse through his heart. One comes to a master to come close. One simply asks for blessings, for nothing else. In the East, it has been a long, one of the ancient most traditions. When Westerners come to the East, they cannot understand it, what is happening. In India, or in Iran, or in Arab, people travel thousands of miles to see a master, just to see a master. They will not ask a single question. They will simply come. And it is a long, arduous journey. Sometimes people will travel on their foot for 1,000 miles just to see a glimpse of the master. The Western mind cannot understand what is the point. If you don't have anything to ask, why you are going? For what? The Western mind understands how to converse, but how to be with, it has forgotten. It knows how to ask. It has forgotten how to drink. It loves intellectual approach. It does not know the door of the heart, that there is a way beyond words to connect and relate. There is a way to participate beyond words. So Westerns have always been puzzled about Eastern people walking thousands of miles, taking a long, arduous journey, sometimes dangerous, and then coming to a master just to touch his feet and asking for his blessings, and then they will go fulfilled, happy. Many people have asked me that when I give sannyas to Westerners, I talk with them, and when I give sannyas to Indians, I simply don't talk with them. What is the matter? Am I not interested in Indians? why I don't talk with Hindus, why I don't try to convey something through language. The reason is not that I am not interested in Indians. The reason is Indians know how to be with. Sometimes I talk to an Indian too who has become almost westernized. And sometimes I don't talk to a westerner too if I feel that his heart is eastern. It depends. When somebody from the east comes, he comes for a totally different reason. He just comes to be there with me for a few seconds. Those few seconds are of great joy. He has not brought a question with him. He has brought a quest. And a question is superficial. The real thing is the quest. The question is in the head. The quest is in the heart. What is there to ask? What is there to ask that I cannot understand looking into your eyes? What is there to ask that I cannot see the moment you enter into my arena of vision? And why waste time asking some futile thing whether God exists or not? The East has known for centuries a different kind, a different quality of communication. It is of communion. He will come, he will touch the feet, he will go down, he will look at the masters, he will just sniff the air around the masters. Just the fragrance. And he feels fulfilled. He had come to see that the impossible happens. He has heard that it happened in Buddha's time. He has heard that it happened in Muhammad's time. He has heard about great masters like Abdul Aziz. He has heard great stories. He wants to see whether it still happens, whether a Buddha is still alive, whether he can find a man of the quality of Muhammad, so that scriptures become valid again. Each master goes on revalidating. Each master is again and again a witness to the eternal truth. The truth can be realized. In the East, people travel far away journeys they make just to see with their own eyes, because you cannot see Buddha now. 2500 years have passed. It is past. It is part of history. You can only read about. You cannot see Krishna now. It is myth. In the East, people want to see somebody who is a Krishna, or a Buddha, or a Muhammad, or a Christ. They want to look into those eyes so that they can again become confident, so that they can again gain trust that yes, it still happens, that God has not forsaken the world yet. That it is not just a story of the past, that it is part of reality. I have heard one evening several of Rabbi Haim of Kosov's disciples, Hasidim, sat together in his house of study and told one another stories about the old ancient masters, Jhadikim, above all about the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov is the founder of Hasidism, one of the greatest souls that have ever walked on earth. And because the telling and the listening were very sweet to them, they were at it even after midnight. Yeah, it is beautiful. It is one of the most delicious experiences in life to talk about people who have attained, to tell stories about them. That's what in the East we call satsang. Talking about God, godly people, talking about those who have realized. It's small anecdotes, parables, stories, which stir your heart, which help you to sing a song, which make you aware of the unknown which is just by the side of the corner, which make you filled with desires and longings for God, which make you feel that to human beings the superhuman has been happening in the past, that it is possible to you too. And in Hasidism, it is one of the most fundamental things to talk about masters, to enjoy, cherish, and be nourished by that talk. In Sufism too, and so is in Zen. All the old stories, those stories go on gathering and go on becoming more and more refined as time passes. The concern is not about historic facts. The concern is more about the essential phenomenon that God happens. So it came to pass that half the night was lost. Then one of them told still another story about the Baal Shem Tov. When he had ended, another sighed from the bottom of his heart. "Alas," said he, half to himself, "where could we find such a man today?" Yes, when you listen about Kabir, Nanak, Dadu, when you listen about Meera, when you listen about Mansur, when you listen about Jalaluddin Rumi, Umar Khayyam, it is natural that a sigh will be released from your heart and you will say, "Alas, where could we find such a man today?" In the East, that's why people travel. If they hear that some master has happened, they travel. People are very poor. They don't have money even to travel. They save their money for years just to go to a place of pilgrimage where they can find somebody who has attained. To help these poor people in the East, we had managed a certain kind of gathering. You must have seen it happening in the Kumbh Mela in Allahabad. The country is poor and millions of people cannot go to the masters. So in the past, it was agreed upon that once in a while the masters will gather together in one place. So the whole country can come there, because it will be difficult for poor people to go in searching all over the country for masters. Out of compassion, the masters decided they should gather in one place. So the whole country can come. Millions of people come to a Kumbh Mela, because there they will be able to see many saints, many sages. The idea was of tremendous utility. It has remained only an idea now. Sages are no more so many. Masters are still there, but not like the ancients. This something has so utterly changed in the world that people no more seek God, or fewer and fewer people seek God. God has become almost irrelevant. People bypass. People are so indifferent about God that they are not even against. Not far, not against, they say, "Okay, don't waste time. Don't talk about useless things. They are not even interested to deny. This is for the first time in the world that the theist and the atheist both have become irrelevant. The world has become indifferent to both. Alas, said he half to himself, where could we find such a man today? At that instant, they heard steps coming down the wooden stairs which led from Rabbi Haim's room. The door opened and Rabbi Haim appeared on the threshold. In the sad jacket he usually wore in the evening, "Fool," he said softly, "he is present in every generation." Then he closed the door and went back up the stairs. The disciples, the Hasidim, sat together in silence. Yes, masters are always there, sometimes more, sometimes less. That depends on the receptivity of a certain age, receptivity of a certain consciousness, receptivity of the time. But it has never happened that they are not there, more or less, right? But they are always there. It cannot happen in the very nature of things that out of millions of people, not even a single person will not be realized. So if there is someone and rumor spreads, people start traveling. But they go to see with their own eyes. They go to touch. They want to see how it feels to touch a God-realized man. They want to have a concrete experience. They want God to be tangible, visible. And God is not tangible and not visible. It happens only rarely that He descends in a man. When a man becomes utterly empty, God descends in him. Then he becomes tangible, visible. You can look into his eyes and you can hold his hands and you can walk with him and you can sit by his side. In the East, people come not to talk, but to listen. Not to talk, but to see. Not to talk, but to feel. This man must have been a very, very Western man, sophisticated, educated in the ways of philosophy. He wrote to Abdul Aziz asking whether he could talk to him in order to make comparisons. What comparisons? With whom? No master is comparable to any other master. Each master is so unique that he is incomparable. You cannot compare Buddha with Muhammad. If you compare, it will be sheer stupidity. And whatsoever you conclude will be wrong. You cannot compare Buddha even with Mahavir. Both were contemporaries and lived in the same province, moved in the same towns, sometimes stayed in the same city, and once stayed in the same dharmasala. But you cannot compare them. They are poles apart. Mahavira is Mahavira, Buddha is Buddha. So unique that not even a single point of comparison exists. If you start comparing, you will miss the whole point. You will miss their reality. That reality is unique. Masters cannot be compared. With no comparison in your mind, if you look into them, you will find the same reality. Hence, darshan. A master's darshan is enough. To see him is enough. You should look deep into his being. Not with thoughts to compare. Not with prejudices. Not with a priori ideas. Just silently, with no thoughts flickering in your mind, with no clouds, just you should look into him and then you will be surprised. They are unique in their manifestation and they are one in their innermost core. Buddha, Mahavir, Krishna, Christ, Lao Tzu, Zarathustra, they are all one in their innermost core. Their circumference is really very, very unique and their center is one. But to see the center, you will have to be utterly silent. Now this man says, I want to make comparisons. If you want to make comparisons, how can you be silent? If you want to make comparisons, you will have to carry all your thoughts that you want to be compared with. You will have to carry all your scriptures, memory. You will have to have logical criterions how to compare. You will have to carry scales to compare. You will be so much burdened with your idea of comparison, you will be not able to see into the reality. Each master is unique and yet represents the universal. The dervish sent him a bottle with oil and water in it and a piece of cotton wick. Enclosed in the package was this letter. Sufis are known to do such things which look absurd on the surface. Now he has asked something else and he is doing something else. He wanted to come to him to have a philosophic understanding what is his message, so that he can compare it with other messages. He wanted to have a look into his system of thought, so he can compare it with other systems of thought and can decide which is better, which is good, which is to be followed. Now this Abdul Aziz sent him a bottle with oil and water in it and a piece of cotton wick. Enclosed in the package was this letter. All scriptures, Sufis say, are like this letter. They have certain instructions, not certain dogmas. They have certain instructions. If you follow those instructions, you will have a door opened to you. But those are not theories to be believed in. Just as you have do-how books, manuals, instruction manuals. They don't preach any philosophy. They simply give you instructions. Do this and this will happen. Do this and this will happen. Don't do this, otherwise this will happen. Buddha used to say that my whole concern is to give you few instructions through which Buddhahood can happen to you. If you ask anything else, I am not interested, he used to say. I am an instructor. I simply give you a few instructions, follow those instructions, things will start happening. I don't say anything about truth, I only say something about the way, how it is reached. Follow the way and you will reach the truth, and truth is indefinable. Nothing can be said about it. Sufis say all real scriptures are not philosophic, they are instructive. They simply give you instructions. Like this letter. Dear friends, if you place the wick in the aisles, you will get light when fire is applied to it. If you pour out the oil and put the wick in water, you will get no light. If you shake up the oil and water and then place the wick in them, you will get a spluttering and a going out. There is no need to carry out this experiment through words and visits when it can be done with such simple materials as these. Now this philosopher must have laughed at this whole ridiculous letter. What nonsense this Abdul Aziz is talking about. And what does it signify? I had asked something else. And he sends a bottle with oil and water in it with a wick. This is absurd. Many times the master's answer will look absurd because you cannot understand the significance of it. First try to understand what is the significance of it. First thing he says that there is no need to come to me. Why travel so far away? If you really want to see reality, it is within you. Just do few experiments and you will enter into yourself. And there you will find me too. Just the other night, a sannyasin was saying to me, I feel it very difficult, he was saying, to surrender to you. I can understand. It is always very difficult to surrender. But I told him, it is difficult because you don't understand. By surrendering to me, you are really surrendering your false self to your real self. I am nobody in it. It is just an excuse. Why am I? Your false self disappears and you reach to your real self. If you can do it directly, if you can make a short circuit, you can do. If it is not possible, then you can do via me. The master is just a via media. When the master says surrender to me, he does not mean surrender to him. He simply means whatsoever you are right now is not the real you. You put all this false idea of yourself. Give it to me. Give this poison to me. By surrendering your false, you become the real. And the real can never be surrendered, so the master is not worried about the real. Real can never be surrendered. There is no way to surrender it. Only the unreal can be surrendered. Or let me say it in this way, you can surrender only that which you really don't have. You cannot surrender that which you really have. You cannot surrender that which you are. Really you are. That is impossible to surrender. You can only surrender that which you have come to believe that you are, but you are not. The master only takes the false. When you come to a master, in fact you come to yourself. And this should be the criterion to judge whether you have come to a real master or you are fooling yourself around a cheat, a fraud. If the master tries to overpower your reality, then beware that man is your enemy. If a master simply takes your unreality and helps your reality to grow in your uniqueness, the real master always goes on throwing you to yourself. Yes, he will snatch all that is unreal. He will pluck all that is unreal. He will take all the weeds out of your being so that the roses can grow. But he is not going to take the roses. Roses cannot be taken away. Your essential self is impossible to surrender. It cannot happen. It is not in the nature of things. The master sends him a simple letter with a very absurd thing, a bottle with oil and water and a wick. Now first try to understand what he signifies. If the man was really a man of some intelligence, he would have understood. But the story does not say anything about him. So the every possibility is that he didn't understand. Otherwise the story must have mentioned it. He must have laughed at the foolishness of this man Abdul Aziz. And he must have thought it is good that I never went. It would have been futile. He must have told to other people, look, this foolish man is pretending as a master. I had inquired about a subtle thing, comparison of his system with my system or other systems. And this is what he sends as a reply. This man either is mad or is a fool. First try to understand what Abdulaziz's message is. Dear friends, if you place the wick in the oil, you will get light when fire is applied to it, first. Second, if you pour out the oil and put the wick in the water, you will get no light. Third, if you shake up the oil and water and then place the wick in them, you will get a spluttering and a going out. Now first, these three things have to be understood. Man is a trinity. Body, mind, soul. And that's what those three things represent. The bottle represents the body. The mind represents water. And if mind becomes meditation, it represents oil. So mind has two possibilities. Either it can be water or oil. If it is with thoughts, it is water. If it is with no thoughts, it is oil. And the soul is the fire. These are the three things. Bottle we have, and we have the possibility either to fill it with oil or with water. And both are the possibilities of the mind. Mind with thoughts becomes water. Then you can go on applying fire to it, there will remain darkness. That's why you live in darkness. Your mind is water. And the fire goes on continuously being put off. With a too much thoughtful mind, the spirit disappears, the fire disappears, the soul is no more there. Unless the body is filled with no mind, unless the body is filled by thoughtlessness or a thoughtless mind, you will not be enlightened. Once mind is no more watery, thoughts have disappeared, and there is silence, purity, innocence, it becomes oil, and suddenly you will see a light arising. The fire is there, just the oil is needed. The bottle is there, the fire is there, just between the two there is water. And with water there is no possibility of fire. You live without fire and without light. Abdulaziz says, if you place the wick in the oil, remember in the oil, if the soul is placed in the oil in meditative state, in samadhi, you will get light, there will be no trouble, you will become enlightened. So don't bother about coming here or going anywhere else. Do a simple thing. Let mind disappear. Let no mind arise. If the body and the soul are connected by no mind, they are in tune. And suddenly there is song, and there is dance, and there is celebration. There is joy. There is eternal joy. What Hindus call Satchidananda. Truth. Consciousness. Bliss. All are there. Once your trinity is in tune, If the Trinity is not in tune, you will remain in darkness. If the mind is there, continuously creating more and more thoughts, you are filled with water. This is the state of the worldly man, the man who continuously thinks day and night, day in, day out. Since birth to death, continuously goes on thinking. He lives without fire. He lives without light. He lives without joy. In fact, he lives a very dead life. Or, one possibility more is there. That is the state of the so-called religious peoples, the otherworldly peoples. You can have a mixture of mind and no mind. Then there will be a spluttering and going out. Then sometimes you will have few glimpses, but they will be gone. Nothing will be really yours. Just like dreams, they will come and go. Mind can have these three states: the ordinary state of thinking, the extraordinary state of contemplation. This is the state of contemplation, water oil mixed. And in the West, people have never searched beyond contemplation. All their words for dhyana or jikra mean only contemplation. Even the word meditation simply means to think in a better way, to meditate. Contemplation means to think in a better way, but thinking remains. Just it becomes more concentrated. It is less zigzag. It is in a direction. It has a goal. It is not insane. It has a certain purpose and meaning, but it remains thinking. It is no more mad. So something of the new mind enters into it, but only something. Water and oil are mixed, and sometimes there will be spluttering and going out. Sometimes the fire will be there, and sometimes it will not be there. There will be lightning experiences. That's what has happened to Christian saints. Their experiences about God are not like Mansur or Abdul Aziz or Buddha. Their experiences of God are just glimpses. They come and they disappear. Good than nothing, but nothing to be compared with that experience which comes and never goes again. Nothing to be compared with enlightenment. So these are the three possibilities. Either the water and oil is mixed, or there is only water, or there is only oil. The worldly man remains with water. The religious man remains with a mixture. And the spiritual man, he starts seeing the point and fills his being with no mind, with dhyana, with a thoughtless awareness, with a contentless consciousness. He is simply alert. Not alert of anything in particular, just alert. He is awake. This wakefulness is all that one has to do. That is the message of Abdul Aziz, but you have to decode it. And I feel sorry for the man to whom Abdul Aziz had sent this. I don't think he was able to decode it. Otherwise the story must have mentions. That's how Sufi and Zen stories go. If something happens, they certainly mention it. It has to be mentioned. But the story says nothing. Dear friend, if you place the wick in the aisle, you will get light when fire is applied to it. If you pour out the aisle and put the wick in the water, you will get no light. If you shake up the aisle and water and then place the wick in them, you will get a spluttering and a going out. There is no need to carry out this experiment through words and visits, when it can be done with such simple materials as these. Sufism is existential, experimental, experiential. It insists that God can be known by simple methods. There is no need to philosophize. Many times people come to me, people who are knowledgeable, and they will say, particularly Indians, that what is the meaning of dancing? How, by dancing, one can attain to God? Dancing is an experiment. An experiment to bring your body, your mind, your soul in tune. Dance is one of the most rhythmic phenomena. If you are really dancing, there is no other activity which creates such unity as dance. If you are sitting, the body is not used. Then you use only your mind. If you are running very fast, your life is in danger, then you use your body, you don't use your mind. In dance, you are neither sitting nor running for your life. It is movement and a joyful movement. The body is moving, the energy is flowing, the mind is moving, the mind is flowing, and when these two things are flowing, they melt into each other. You become psychosomatic. A certain alchemy starts happening. That's why you see a new kind of grace on the face of the dancer. It is alchemical. The body, mind, meeting, merging. The body, mind, beginning one tune, one rhythm, one harmony. When this harmony has happened, then the third, the soul starts entering into it. Because the soul can enter into your existence only when your body and mind are no more in conflict. When your body and mind cooperate, when your body and mind are deep in love, embracing, hugging each other, that's what happens in dance. Then immediately you will find the third also entering. When the body and mind are really in harmony, the two are no more two, the third enters. You become for the first time a Trinity, a Trimurti. Those are the three faces of God. And while you are dancing, something is happening. It is an experiment. It is not just contemplation, just sitting and thinking about God. It is allowing God to enter in you. It is opening yourself to God. It is like a flower opening in the morning. When the flower opens, suddenly some rays start dancing on its petals. When you open, God starts dancing in you. God can be met only through dance. There is no other activity which is more harmonious than dance. That's why all the primitive religions were dance-based. And all the modern religions, the so-called civilized, sophisticated religions, have nothing like dance in them. They are dull affairs. A church looks more like a cemetery than like a temple. You can't dance there. You can't be joyous there. You cannot. It is not allowed. You have to be serious. You have to be very, very serious. Sad. As if you are doing something wrong. The joy is missing. The joy is missing because people are just sitting, not doing anything. And the church goes on just thinking about God. The preacher talks about God and the people listen about it. The preacher thinks and the people who listen, they think. God is a thought. It is not an act in the church. In this place, God is not a thought. It is an act. It is a dance. And the dance has to be of the total body, mind, soul. Nothing has to be denied. Because if you deny anything, something will be missing. Something will be certainly missing. And then your synthesis will not be the highest possibility. It will remain somewhere low. It will not reach to its ultimate Everest. These people who come here and watch, and they say people are dancing, are doing kundalini, are the dynamic, they become very puzzled because they have an idea that one should sit and read Gita and think about God. That is all nonsense. But reading Gita and thinking about God, you are not going to go anywhere. If you really want to go somewhere, you have to be experimental. You have to use some methods. Sufism has a method and has no philosophy. There is no need to carry out this experiment through words and visits, because how can you carry out an experiment through words and visits? Yes, words can be used for instruction. That's why I go on doing every morning. These are just instructions. Then the whole day, words disappear from this ashram. Then you dance. Then you hum. Then you shake. Then you sit. Then you watch. Then you love. You pray, you meditate. Every morning I start with instructions, and then the whole day is for you to experiment. Words can be used, but only as instructions, not as propositions. I am not here creating any belief system in you. I am destroying all belief systems. I am simply giving you a few methods, few techniques. If you know how to use them, and if you are really interested in search and you use them, there is no reason why you should not attain. There is no reason at all why you cannot become God realized. If it has happened to me, it can happen to you. If you cooperate with me, it is going to happen to you. A master goes on taking everything from you. First he teaches you to become a disciple, and one day he will take your disciplehood also, because the master cannot be satisfied unless you have become masters in your own right. A Sadguru is one who creates Sadgurus. A master goes on creating masters. First he teaches you to surrender so that all that is false disappears. Once that false has disappeared, he will tell you to surrender, surrender to. Once the false has disappeared, he will tell you to now surrender your disciplehood to. A master is satisfied only when he has created another master. In the vicinity of a master, a chain starts working. One flame jumps into other lamps and they start burning, and then they, in their own right, will start jumping into other unlit lamps, and many more will be burned. People come to me and ask, why I am not going in the world? I need not go. I will create many Sadgurus. I will create many masters just sitting here. They will be traveling. They will be my ambassadors. They will go around the world to share their light. But one has to go deep into experimentation, because only through experimentation there is experience. Through philosophizing, people avoid taking risks. I have heard an aged couple was listening to a broadcast church service. Both sat in deep contemplation, and half an hour went by. Then suddenly the old man burst into a fit of laughter. "Sandy," exclaimed his wife in a horrified tone, "why this merriment on the Sabbath?" "Ah," said Cindy, the preacher has just announced the offering, and here I am safe at home." People want to remain safe, uninvolved, uncommitted. They want to grow, but they don't want to commit. They want to grow, but they don't want to sacrifice anything. They want to grow for nothing. They don't want to pay. These people never grow. Growth is through sacrifice. One has to put all one has at the stake. Growth is a gamble. It is a risk. So if you are trying to save yourself, let me warn you. If you are trying to save yourself, you may be successful. You may succeed in saving yourself. But then nothing will happen. You have to be open. You have to be ready to lose yourself, not save. Philosophy is very good because it never touches your reality. It simply goes on like a cloud hovering around your mind. You can enjoy it. It is an easy chair thing. You can go into great thoughts. There is no fear. You are always safe, anchored in your home, anchored in your security, safety. That's why I insist for sannyas. Sannyas means now you are becoming committed. Now you are getting involved. Now it is not just a philosophy with me. You are ready to go into danger, in the unknown, in the insecure. Many people say, if we listen to you and we meditate, will not it help? Why there is a need to become sannyasis? The need is to commit. The need is to get involved. The need is that you should not stand aloof, saving yourself, and then trying something. If you can grab something by trying, good, but you don't want to get into anything. You don't want to get into any troubles. But these people are the losers. Their cleverness is not going to help them. Their very cleverness will prove their doom. The philosophy is simple mind journey. You don't go anywhere. You remain where you are. it is a dream projection. You can sit here and close your eyes and you can be in Calcutta or in Chicago. You can close your eyes and you can be anywhere you like. But whenever you will open your eyes, you will find yourself sitting here in Pune. That's what philosophy goes on doing. You can think great thoughts. And while you are thinking, you are thrilled. And whenever you will come back and open your eyes, you are exactly the same as you have been always. Nothing ever changes through philosophy. Because philosophy is an avoidance. It simply goes on labeling things. This is this, that is that. Philosophy is labeling. And remember, you are not kidding anybody else but yourself. It happens, two lions were in a zoo. One of them had been there for several years, while the second one was a newcomer. At feeding time, the new lion noticed that he received a few figs, nuts and bananas, while the older one was given a luscious, juicy chunk of meat. After this had gone for several weeks, the young lion plucked up courage enough to inquire why this was so. "I know you have the seniority around here. But why do you always get the meat while I get fruit and nuts?" he asked. "Well," explained the other lion, "the zoo manager is a philosopher. And the zoo is so poor that he has only room for one lion. So he has listed you as a monkey." Now by listing a lion as a monkey, a lion does not become a monkey. But the old lion says, because he is a philosopher, he thinks by labeling things are finished. He treats you as a monkey. That's what philosophy goes on doing. You go on labeling things. Once you have labeled, you start treating them that way. Beware of this habit. Everybody has it. You are sitting by the side of somebody and you inquire, "Who are you? Where are you going? What is your religion?" This and that. And this is just an effort to label the man. If he says he is a Jew, you have labeled him. Then you know that you have to protect your pockets. He is a Jew. Now you have labeled him. And he may not be a man that you can label as a Jew. Because in that way Jesus also was a Jew. Even if Jesus was sitting by your side, he would have said, "I am a Jew." How you were going to label him? You would have labeled him Jew? He was the least Jewish man in the world. Or the man says, "I am a Mohammedan," and you think that he is dangerous. Or the man says, "I am a Hindu," and you think he is a hypocrite. People have universals, labels. Once they have labeled, they behave with the label. They don't think about the person at all. And each person is so unique. Represents nobody else. Represents only himself. So nobody can be labeled. No label is good. And philosophy goes on doing that. It goes on labeling whole existence. Once the philosopher has labeled everything, he thinks he is finished. He has accounted for everything. And he starts living in a very comfortable, labeled world. God is in heaven, and hell is underneath the earth, and heaven is high in the sky, and this earth is just on the middle, in the middle, and he has made a map, and he knows what is right and what is wrong, and if you do the right, you will go to heaven, if you do the wrong, you will go to hell. Everything is categorized, finished. Now he knows all. And a philosopher knows nothing. To know, philosophy is not the door. To know, experimentation, religion is the door. It happens, a hospital secretary moved to a new post and decided immediately to tighten up on security. He set up a man in the gatehouse with very strict instructions to challenge all comers. Those not on business were to be turned firmly away. The man who was put on the door was a great thinker. Quite soon a young woman marched up, seeking to enter. "Hi, wait a bit. What is your business?" shouted the gatekeeper, the thinker. "I am a maternity patient," said the girl. "Can you prove it? Are you pregnant?" "Don't be daft. I have not seen anything for 6 months." "Ah, I thought so. You have come to the wrong place. The eye hospital is further down the road." The people who are addicted with thinking have their own logic. They don't listen. They don't see. They are always garbed behind their own thinking. Now the woman says, "Don't be daft, I have not seen anything for 6 months." And the thinker concludes, "Right, I thought so. You have come to the wrong place. The eye hospital is further down the road." He has missed the whole point. Thinking is like that. It goes on missing the whole point. If you really want to have any contact with reality, then thinking is not the bridge, it is the barrier. Just within 300 years, science has touched great heights. And the reason? The reason is simple. The reason is Bacon introduced into the world of science experiment. Just in 300 years, so much has happened that it has not happened in 3,000 years or even 30,000 years. It depends on one man, Bacon, who changed the whole course of science and whole course of human consciousness. Just creating a new door of experimentation. He said, speculation is not going to help. People have speculated down the ages. Nothing has happened. They go on quarreling about theories. And those theories don't mean a thing. He introduced experiment. You will be surprised. From where Bacon got the idea of experiment, you will not believe it. He got it from Sufism. He was a great reader of Sufi books. He was immensely interested in Sufi books. And from the Sufi ideas, he got the idea that if experiment is the door in the inner world, why not experiment can be the door for the outer? Science owes much to Sufism because of this. If someday the right sources are searched for, then the real fathers of science will be the Sufis, not the Greek philosophers, Aristotle, Plato and others. No. They were all speculators. From where the idea of experiment entered into the mind of Bacon, it entered from Sufism. He may have read this story or something else. But it entered from Sufism because Sufis are very persistent on experiments. And if religion also going to grow, then experiment has to become its very foundation. just as science has taken such a great height within such a small time limit, 300 years, religion can also have great possibilities if it becomes experimental. Religion has to learn much from Sufism. Sufism is the essential most religion. That's why I say it is existential, experimental, experiential. Enough for today.